Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a December 14, 2008 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us today is a very special guest, Mr. Richard W. Hennis. And Mr. Hennis, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
So welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, you have quite a distinction as being the first manufacturer of what we would call, or what you called, a water welder. Is that not so?
Yes.
And when did this happen, and how did it come to take place that you began manufacturing such a thing as a torch that uses the component gases of water as its welding gases?
That was some 40 years ago, over 40 years ago. And I can't remember the details of how we decided to do it, but I know Bill Rhodes built the or assembled the device that contained the hydrogen and oxygen gases that we used for our small torch.
Now, when you say Bill Rhodes, you're referring to the physicist William Rhodes.
Yes.
And so was this something that someone commissioned you to do? Did someone ask you for this product, or did you just decide it would be a good idea to make a water welder?
Well, we thought since I guess it was about the turn of the century that high school students were breaking down water into hydrogen and oxygen by electrolysis, that if we could take those two gases and make a very small torch, it would have a niche in the industrial markets. And so Bill was working on the box to do that.
Okay, and he secured a patent for that box.
Yes, he did.
Now, was that his idea to create what we call a series electrolysis cell?
Well, no. The electrolysis cell is old in the art. It was his idea to build a machine, or I should say a device, that would contain the two gases, hydrogen and oxygen, one emitted at the anode and one emitted at the cathode, contain those two gases together, conduct them through a series of hoses and flashback arresters to a hypodermic needle, torch tip, where they were burned off in a very tiny flame. It wasn't a process to necessarily efficiently produce the flame, because the flame can be produced more efficiently by other means. But a flame this small did have a niche application in industry.
In particular with jewelers, or?
Oh, yes, jewelers, but the jewelry application wasn't really that great. It was more in electronics.
Soldering circuits and so on, or?
Yes, yes, that was one of the applications. Another application was stripping wires, stripping the insulation off of wires by burning it off in this tiny flame. You could burn it off so fast that you wouldn't heat the wire much. And it had special applications that I'm not even privy to what they were using it for. But for the very tiny, high-temperature flame, there were niche applications.
Okay. Now, you were already involved in manufacturing at the time that you undertook this new product. Is that correct?
Oh, yes.
And what was Hennis Corporation doing then? You were manufacturing a number of different items?
We were manufacturing aircraft parts. We also manufactured semiconductor parts and computer parts.
Okay, and this is back in the late 50s, early 60s, is that right? Or?
Yes, it was in the early 60s, or the late 50s, I would say. That's correct as well.
Okay, so when you decided to undertake this project, it was you and William Rhodes and anyone else?
Well, no, it was my company. And Bill was hired, and it was his idea to do this. And
yeah.
I agreed that we would, go ahead and do it.
Now, someone who stole a lot of the limelight was Yul Brown, who was an Australian inventor. And, in fact, the gas, Brown's gas, was named after him.
Oh, really? Well, I'm really not familiar with that.
Well, the interesting thing is that although the gas was named after him, he actually cited William Rhodes' patent in his own patent.
Oh, well, the gas is, there's really nothing patentable about the gas. The gas is hydrogen and oxygen. And the elemental components of water are hydrogen and oxygen. If you break water down, you get hydrogen and oxygen. So there's nothing patentable about the gases.
No, it was the device that was patented. But for some reason, Mr. Brown, his dedication to this technology of breaking water down resulted in the gas being named Brown's gas.
Oh, really? Well, I wasn't. Well, Brown's gas, it isn't much of a thing, really, because the gas is two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen, and that's water.
Now, when you were producing this device, what did you prefer to call the gas? Were you calling it oxyhydrogen or?
Oxyhydrogen. That's exactly what the gas was.
Okay. And that's what I like to call it. I think oxyhydrogen is a good name for it.
Well, certainly is, because I don't know. You can put anybody's name on a gas like that you wish, but the gas is merely a combination of the breakdown products of water.
Okay. Now, did you say, as we were discussing this earlier, that there was perhaps some controversy as to the nature of the gas?
Well, yes. The tiny, tiny flame that we had seemed to be hotter than it should be. And there was some speculation that extra heat was caused by atomic hydrogen being emitted somehow or another from the electrolytic process into molecular hydrogen to combine with the oxygen to form water again. And so the speculation was that the atomic hydrogen, let's call it burning, its burning caused the temperature of the flame to be higher. I couldn't say whether that's true or not, but that was what was speculated.
Well, that's interesting. And so the normal bottled hydrogen that a person would buy from a welding supply would be H2, right?
Yes, it would be a molecular hydrogen.
And you're saying that what comes out of a Hennis water welder was perhaps individual hydrogen atoms as opposed to hydrogen molecules?
Well, some. The hydrogen molecules were certainly most of it. But there may have been some atomic hydrogen in it. Now, that's speculation.
But you're saying that some of the properties of the gas, how hot it could get and so on, could have indicated that there was some atomic hydrogen present. Is that the idea?
Well, it indicated that the gas was hotter than normally you would figure an oxyhydrogen flame would be.
Much hotter than a bottled hydrogen and bottled oxygen flame would be.
I don't say much, but some, yes.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that necessarily it was. I'm saying that that was speculated.
At any rate, you've been out of the business for quite some time, right?
Between 40 and 50 years.
But in other words, for how long did you actually manufacture the water welder?
Hey, wait a minute. No. I sold my company 25 years ago.
Okay.
But you know, we had that water welder going for about over 15 years.
Really? You were manufacturing? How many units do you think you produced in that time, approximately?
Oh, goodness. I don't know anymore.
I mean, were you cranking out 1,000 of them a year or something? Or?
No. I don't know. Nothing like that. It was a small market, and it wasn't a market that all by itself would support any kind of a manufacturing company. But it was one product that was nice to have.
And so what did one of those units sell for when you first introduced it to the marketplace in 1964? Can you remember what the price would have been?
I think it was $150.
Isn't that something? Well, I'd love to have one now for that.
Well, it was small. It was the size of maybe two shoeboxes.
Uh-huh. And what did it have as far as configuration inside it? It had a round metal drum with bolts that held plates together on either end of it?
No. It was a cylindrical tank, and the cover of the cylindrical tank was had suspended from it the anode. The tank itself was the cathode, and there was an old ring that insulated the cover from the tank so that you had an anode and a cathode immersed in the solution, which was potassium hydroxide and water, potassium hydroxide being the conducting agent, and so that the water would be broken down by electrolysis, as kids were doing in their high school classes. These two gases were then conducted through, as I say, a series of hoses and flashback arresters to a hypodermic needle torch tip, where they were burned off to form water again. The whole process is nothing that was efficient at all, because the heat energy of the electricity that input that was required was much greater than the heat energy of the flame that was delivered. So it wasn't a matter of efficiency or anything like that. Like I've heard people talk about running cars with this method, the only way you would run a car with it is have a very long extension cord to your car, and then when you reach the end of your extension cord, your trip was over.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because in the, I believe it was the Pittsburgh newspaper this week, there was a cartoon from their political cartoonist of GM's new electric car, and it had a 40-mile extension cord reeled up on the back of it.
Okay. Well,
showing that they're quite incapable of producing a decent electric car.
Well,
but,
yeah, I, of course, I have no feelings on that, but... Yeah,
but what about the flashback arrestor you mentioned a couple times?
Okay, the flashback arrestor that we ended up using was like a stone. It was a grinding wheel stone. It was actually we bought our stones from I forget the name of the company that made grinding wheels.
Does that mean that it was a piece of lava rock?
Oh no. This I believe it was it was a silicon, like a silicon grinding wheel that they would use in a machine shop.
And how did you arrive at it as being a good flashback arrestor for oxyhydrogen?
Just because it defined very small passages in it. And the passages were small enough that the flame passing through the stone, I mean the gas passing through the stone, was passing at a velocity greater than the velocity of the flame that wanted to burn backward into the stone.
And that was a serious problem when you're mixing both hydrogen and oxygen together, isn't it?
You had to be quite careful, yes.
So you were using a stone as your flashback arrestor.
Correct.
And then you were using a very narrow welding hose, right?
Well, the diameter of the welding hose was, no, it wasn't narrow. It was a quarter-inch hose.
Okay. But then when you finally passed the gas through a cutting or a torch tip, you found that you needed to use something as small as a hypodermic needle?
Oh, yes, sure. All of our torch tips were hypodermic needles.
Unmodified, just straight hypodermic needles.
Straight needles. Well, they were modified to the extent that they were cut off square at the end and not angled.
But you simply took a medically available hypodermic needle and pushed it into the end of your quarter-inch hose, or did you have a special tip adapter?
Well, we had a little handpiece, and the handpiece had a flashback arrestor in it.
Oh, it did?
Oh, sure.
And what was that? The same type material?
Same stone.
Okay. Now, did you find that you needed to backwash these stones to get out particulate matter from the electrolyte, or?
We never did.
Okay. I read somewhere that there were some instructions that in order to clean out the potassium hydroxide that accumulated in the stone, it would be necessary to wash it out occasionally.
Well, that would be a way of doing it, yes. I don't recall that we ever did it.
Okay, so that wasn't a problem then. You didn't have any issues with potassium hydroxide residue being included in the flame that was coming out of the torch?
None. No, none at all.
You didn't try to scrub the gases or anything?
No.
There was no effort made to scrub the electrolyte from the stream of gas?
Oh.
Okay. Well, very interesting. And so I've seen evidence from the 1800s. There's mention made of an oxyhydrogen blowpipe. Were you all aware of that, of anyone ever having tried to make an oxyhydrogen torch during the 19th century?
No, I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know about that.
Did you ever research or discover that a limelight from theaters back in the 19th century used oxyhydrogen?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think the presence of oxyhydrogen with lime produces an extremely brilliant theatrical lighting, and that's where the expression limelight comes from.
I imagine they were getting their oxyhydrogen by electrolysis.
You would think, yeah. So that's one of the reasons why I opened the world's first water fuel museum, was to bring out in the open this history, this fascinating history of turning water into combustible gases.
Yeah, we played a very small part in that.
Well, you may think so, but that's only because you haven't kept up with what's happened since you stopped manufacturing these things. Believe it or not, you actually began an industry which is growing, and it's very prevalent in the Far East. In fact, someone who knows quite a bit about this says that many of the Chinese products that are coming into the U.S., and of course our Walmart stores are filled with those products,
If
they have any welding done on them, that welding is being done by one of your welders.
Oh, really?
If you can believe that.
Oh, I wasn't aware of it.
Obviously not a welder that you manufactured, but a welder that's a knockoff of the welder that you manufactured 40 years ago.
Well, I'm glad it's useful.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
So we in the United States are not being encouraged to use one of your machines or something like it. But in other countries where the manufacturing has moved to, you know,
yes,
where all of our factories that are shutting down here with our oxyacetylene torches, the factories that are now building these things for us that involve welding are using a Hennis type welder.
Oh, really? It's hard for me to believe it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
What about the cost comparison of propane or oxyacetylene to your gas? Did you ever do a cost comparison on it?
No, I never did, but I do know that if you were to tell me that our process was only 20% efficient, I would be unable to argue against it. It wasn't efficiency, really. It was the tiny, tiny flame through a hypodermic needle that had a niche market, and that's all we depended upon.
Yeah, you weren't out to increase the efficiency of the process to the point where it became less expensive to produce the gas. The average person who wanted to use this device was satisfied that if they could plug it in the wall and produce the gas, that was okay. They didn't care about efficiency so much.
That's exactly correct. It was handy.
Right. Well,
you have to add water, of course, to your water welder. As you use your water, you'd have to pour water in. The electrolyte stayed inside. You didn't have to worry about that.
In other words, you didn't have to add more of the potassium hydroxide.
Oh, no. You never added that.
You just
only
added
water.
More distilled water, I suppose?
Oh, yes. Yes, distilled.
Uh-huh. Do you remember the concentration of potassium hydroxide you were striving for in the beginning when you added it in the factory?
It was highly concentrated. I don't recall.
And then, of course, for plates and for the chamber, you were using stainless steel?
Oh, no. Well, we use stainless steel for the top plate, but for the actual anode, we used pure nickel.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And what was the shape of the anode?
Well, it was cylindrical.
You had a cylinder within a cylinder? Is that the idea?
Correct.
And no attempt made to separate the gases?
Well, over the years we did some of that, and we were able to separate them, but there was really not a big reason to do that.
Yeah, because you're using the gases together, why not just go ahead and duct them together?
Correct. We had some ideas, and I don't, you know, that's so long ago, I can't recall.
Yeah.
But we were able to produce separated gases, but it required a lot more structure, and it wasn't anything that we followed up a lot.
Well, do you think that concern over a flashback going back to the chamber and blowing it up would have caused you to want to separate the gases?
Well, no, because we intentionally caused many, many flashbacks to take place in our chamber, and it wasn't a problem. We had
so in other words, your chamber, it was built strong enough to endure an explosion.
Yeah, but if you had a plugged-up filter and you built up great, great pressure back in the generating chamber and then flashed it back, you could pop the O-ring.
But not blow the thing up.
No, it seems to me somebody blew one up in the air once, but I don't recall it, and it's not a big explosion.
But you never knew of anyone being hurt by such a thing?
I beg your pardon?
You never knew of someone being injured or seriously hurt by one of your units?
No. That may have happened, but I don't know about it.
Well, you probably would have heard if someone were killed or seriously injured.
Oh. I would think so.
Well, in other words, you all designed enough safety in your device, in your welder, that I never heard of anyone being hurt by one.
No, I really haven't either. No, you could fire back into the chamber and it wouldn't do anything. But if you had it plugged up and you built that chamber into a very high pressure chamber, you'd have a lot of hydrogen and oxygen in that chamber, and you could pop the O-ring out of it.
Yeah. But you all
you got
built
a flame
it,
back there.
Yeah, you built it stout enough to prevent that kind of problem.
Yes.
Well, let me tell you a humorous story about one of your units.
Okay.
I opened this museum in Kentucky in 2005, and there was a fellow who's a pipe fitter. He's a union scale, boiler maker pipe fitter.
Yes.
And his wife saw a newspaper article about my museum. And they live about 50 minutes from Lexington, Kentucky. They live in the mountains of eastern Kentucky. And she knew that her husband would want to go to this museum and see this history of turning water into combustible fuel.
Well,
and so she told him on his birthday, she said, "I'm taking you into Lexington and we're going to have a meal and I'm going to take you to a museum." And that was her birthday present to him.
Oh, really?
So he comes to the museum and I showed him an acrylic box that had about 60 6x6 stainless steel plates in it, a series electrolysis cell.
Okay.
And I told him that it was possible to use it as a torch. It produced enough liters per minute of gas to sustain a flame. So he went home, and as he was in the ensuing weeks, he was messing around on his junk pile. Welders many times will have a junk pile where they can get scrap steel for building various things and so on. And he notices on his junk pile that there's one of your water welders.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, a factory that he works at in Winchester, Kentucky, had given him a pile of junk and said to haul this off for us. And he didn't even know what he was putting in the back of his truck, but he unloaded it at his home beside his shop. And on this occasion, he took note of the fact that it said water welder on one of these pieces of junk that he'd collected.
Yeah.
So he took it into his shop. The hose was missing on it, and he may have had to replace the cord, but he plugged it in. The thing worked.
Yeah, it worked.
It worked. I kid you not. And this is one of your units from many years ago because it looks very old.
I'll be darned.
So he called me up and he said, "Guess what?" He says, "I've got a water welder." He says, "I found it in my backyard." I said, "You got to be kidding. You found it?" So I went over to his place, and that was the first time I'd ever seen one of your devices.
Well, understand that I sold that business in 1983. And it's possible that a successor may have built units that I know nothing of.
Oh, yeah, it's quite possible. I think they're still manufacturing them, as far as I know.
Well, they were as far as I know, but I haven't kept track of that.
I can't remember the name of the company. It's not Hennis anymore.
I think the fellow that ended up with it there called it Oxy Hydrogen Company or something.
Yeah, or Arizona Hydrogen or something like that.
Okay. Well,
I think they're still in Phoenix. Is that where your company was?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
So there is someone in Phoenix that's manufacturing and selling these things.
Well, I know that the fellow that was doing it was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, really?
That's what I was told.
Well, that's too bad. And of course, Mr. Rhodes died a couple years ago, so...
I wasn't aware of that either.
Well, and I'm very thankful that you were willing to share your experience with our audience, because people are very interested in hearing the voice of someone directly involved in this industry, and knowing that you're really the father of this kind of device, at least in modern times. If someone was doing it in the 1800s, we don't know who they were. But
but do be aware of this, that it's a high school chemistry project to make hydrogen and oxygen from water. It's nothing new about it. I would say they've been doing that since the turn of the century, at least the turn of the last century.
Yeah, but it's very nice to be able to speak with you and to hear your role in it, especially how nonchalant you are about it. There are plenty of people who, prior to this interview, had no idea who you were and what your role was, and I'm sure they're very glad to be able to hear your expressions of humility regarding your role in this development of this technology.
Okay, well, remember now, what we developed was mechanical in nature. The chemistry of the water is something that was here long before us.
Yeah, and it is quite an awesome fluid, isn't it?
Well, it served many purposes.
Well, again, I'm thankful for your willingness to participate in this, especially at such late notice. And
let me leave you with one final thing that you should keep in mind, that the water welder was actually an energy conversion device, converting electrical energy in the form of watts into heat energy in the form of BTUs. The heat energy and BTUs being a small, very small torch flame. But remember, it's energy conversion, watts to BTUs. That's all it is.
Yes. And then
you can follow that line of thought.
Yeah, and that's the beginning of the story.
Okay.
The end of the story, other people have picked up and run with it, and there's some quite amazing claims. I'm surprised you never heard of Ewell Brown, but I'd like to share some information with you at some other time about his work. He spent many years taking your device and turning it into a much larger flame tip than what you all did.
Uh-huh.
Ewell, concentrating on the jewelry and the electronics industry, whereas he decided to produce a flame that was comparable to an acetylene-type torch flame.
Okay.
And he found that some very unusual properties of the oxyhydrogen flame were able to be identified, such as up to and including the neutralizing of nuclear waste. Now, that may sound strange, but this guy's a scientist. He was actually a Bulgarian who immigrated to Australia, and one of his claims is that an oxyhydrogen flame can reduce the radioactivity of nuclear waste.
Well, I suppose an acetylene flame could do the same.
Well, I think it has to do with this atomic hydrogen that you were referring to. An acetylene flame doesn't have that, you see.
Oh, well, now remember, that's a speculation.
Yes, exactly. But that's something that we... As you said, this is a very old technology. How come we're still speculating about it? Why hasn't science delved into the confirmation or the refutation of these claims?
So that's
part of what this program is all about, to try to get the wheels turning so that we do learn more about water and the gases that it produces.
Okay. I don't really know, excepting it probably is not... economically worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, that's what's been said, and that's something we need to continue to explore. Well, listen, it's been so nice talking to you, Mr. Hennis, and look forward to doing a follow-up interview sometime in the future. Maybe we can learn some more of your history and what's happened with your products.
Okay. Now, where can I see this? That's right. You've given me a website. I'll go there and see if I can hear myself.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Feel free to share the link with anyone who'd be interested.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.